Hello and welcome to The Wire Weekly, with the best stories of the week from daily episodes of The Wire. I'm Amina Shakir, coming to you from Radio 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. Thanks for being with us today. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Walkley Foundation. And today on the show...
Australia does not do guns, we don't do mass shootings, and we don't do intercommunal violence.
We spoke with Multicultural Affairs Minister Julian Hill about the new hate speech laws.
The cost of food, in particular the cost of healthy food in Australia, has increased.
According to a survey, more than half of university students cannot afford enough food. And later today...
I've got this opportunity now to go everywhere and bring this little bit of passion that I have to so many places, particularly in the country areas.
We sat down with Australian Day Ambassador Luke Taylor to speak about regional leadership. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. The Parliament House has introduced laws against hate speech, extremism and anti-Semitism after the tragedy at Bondi in December last year. But with a rise in protests against migration in Australia, how can these laws be helpful for multicultural communities? The Wire's Eduardo Jordan spoke with Member for Griffith, Renee Coffey, and Assistant Minister for Regional Multicultural Affairs, Julian Hill, and asked about how the electorates received the news of the Bondi tragedy in December.
I think here locally, across the country, it was incredibly shocking. I know people in our community were very disturbed. We held a get-together shortly after at West End, and we had a condolence book where people could come down and leave their condolences, and we had a lot of people come down wanting to share their thoughts on what had happened, but of course, yeah, very shocked.
My community in southeast Melbourne was similarly shocked, but I think every Australian was horrified by what happened. It was the worst ever terrorist attack on Australian soil, a horrific anti-Semitic attack. At the very moment that Jewish Australians should have been safe celebrating Hanukkah, a celebration of light over dark on the iconic Bondi Beach, a place where Australia's famed egalitarianism is on display to the world, at that very moment, our nation failed them. And it will change our country, our self-conception that Australia does not do guns, we don't do mass shootings, and we don't do intercommunal violence.
So last week, Parliament passed laws introducing hate speech, extremism, anti-Semitism bill, etc. And there are some concerns from different parties on freedom of speech. How will this guarantee social cohesion?
Social cohesion is a dynamic process. It's not an end state. It's not a point that we get to and we say, oh, we're cohesive. It's a process that requires constant work. And Australia is proudly, I think, the world's most successful multicultural society. But that takes work. It doesn't just happen. The truth is, as Australians know, our social cohesion has been under strain in recent years. There's a whole range of reasons for that. Some of it is the digital world. It's social media, creating algorithms and echo chambers. Some of it is foreign malign influence, particularly in certain communities, again, using the internet and differences in society. Some of it is the weaponization, shamefully, of foreign conflicts here. So there's a whole range of reasons that our social cohesion is under strain. Some of it also toxic spillover politics from Europe and America. Australia does not suffer mass migration, as even the Liberal Party's immigration spokesperson has acknowledged. We have tightly controlled borders, a tightly controlled migration program, but our social cohesion is under strain. The terrorists turned up at Bondi with hatred and bigotry in their hearts and guns in their hands. And the government's response has to deal with both the motive, the hate, and also the method, the guns. Overwhelmingly, Australians, we see from the research, and I know from the feedback I've had from my community and others around the country, support the government's response.
And in which way will this bill protect multicultural communities?
I think for us here locally, since the Bondi terrorist, anti-Semitic terrorist attack, we've had more engagement with our local communities, with our Muslim communities, with our Jewish communities here locally in Griffith. And the conversations that we've been having, and they continue on since before then, around the fact that people lately have felt unsafe in their community displaying their religious or cultural background. I've had members of our Jewish community say that they've felt uncomfortable in their gyms, and locally Muslim people who wear a hijab feeling uncomfortable in the streets. And as Julian, the minister, was saying, that we know that there's conflict overseas, and I think for us in our community, many people here have family overseas, and you know, our heart goes out to what is happening overseas in many instances. What What we don't want to see is that conflict brought here to Australia, and we want to ensure that that social cohesion here locally is upheld and that people here can feel safe.
I just agree with everything that Renee's just said, and I'll just make two extra points. To me, and I've had cause to reflect and talk about this with Australia Day quite recently, an Australian to me is anyone committed to our country, to our democratic system of government and institutions, to our shared Australian values, but also to that principle of mutual respect for their fellow Australians who may, or in many cases almost certainly, are very different. They may believe different things, they may look different, they may have a different ancestry or first language, but the magic of Australian multiculturalism happens when we share and build understanding. Hate and violence don't result from diversity. Hate and violence result because of misinformation, polarisation, miscommunication of those differences. And so laws can only do so much. The second point I'd make is that just being a diverse country is not the same thing as being a successful multicultural country. Success, I think, requires three things. It requires laws and institutions. Success requires investments, and we continue to make those investments often to help people settle in. But the most important ingredient of success is not one that can be legislated, it's leadership. It's political leadership that sets the tone for discourse in the country.
Member for Griffith, Renee Coffey, and Assistant Minister for Multicultural Affairs, Julian Hill there, speaking with The Wire's Eduardo Jordan. This week, Australia recognises members of the community who have positively impacted their communities across different areas by naming Australia Day ambassadors throughout the country. Luke Taylor is this year's ambassador from Junee in New South Wales and is the founder of Crime Story Australia, an organisation teaching students different problem-solving skills through planned crime scenes. Mr. Taylor is a former detective as well and has provided opportunities for rural and regional schools with the program. The Wise contributor from 1RPH, Sarah Guys, started asking him his thoughts of being an Australia Day ambassador.
I've been privileged and honoured to be chosen to be an Australia Day ambassador. I represent so many people in Australia who have to overcome adversity and also bring a lot of positivity. And I do that through a lot of the roles that I do is bringing workshops to schools right across country, New South Wales, into areas like the Riverina. And yeah, I try and bring positivity and new learning to students when I visit these schools.
But you're not just millions of Australians. You've actually got a really interesting background. You're a former police officer and you've done a complete about face and moved into teaching. Tell me how that happened.
Yeah, well, in Sydney in the North Coast for a number of years, I was a detective for just short of 15 years. In the last couple of years, I was in child protection. I had a very interesting and action-packed career, but like a lot of roles, particularly in roles that are so confronting like that, I got to a point and I had a mental breakdown and I just couldn't do the role of police anymore. So it was about reinventing myself, and I had a couple of years in the wilderness in recovery, and I went to uni to get my mind off the trauma, and I had a love for literacy and communication, including radio, which is why I love this opportunity so much. And it led me to doing subjects at uni based on literacy, and that led to becoming a high school English teacher. And along that journey, I saw that my past had still had so much to offer, and it was very engaging for the students. So I started in developing this way of teaching literacy. It was experiential learning, but with a literacy focus. So as kids got hands-on, because I'd set up crime scenes and teach them and engage them through doing hands-ons, and it just engages them and it just works.
I can imagine that the kids walking into an English class would not be expecting a crime scene and would be really fascinated by that.
It does. And look, from the technical point of view, it makes teaching quite easy because we have to, you can imagine what a standard classroom is like in our school systems these days, Sarah, and the fact that we have to differentiate on so many different levels to so many different learning types. Everyone learns a different way and we have so many different learning needs. And so when I walk in, I have the crime scene set, every student has a level of complexity in investigating and some items and some exhibits that they are drawn to. And then I can stand back as the teacher and I can accelerate and build each student, not with 300 different storylines, but they've got the basis to start investigating and writing and learning, and then I can instantly see what a student is struggling with and where they're at, and then accelerate them to a more complex component within that investigation. So it means as a teacher, I don't have to get my head around 30 different individual projects, and everyone learns together and they learn from each other when I put them in a group environment. You can't do it in every classroom every day when you're a full-time teacher, but this is something that, and I'm proud, and I love the fact that I've got this opportunity now to go everywhere and bring this little bit of passion that I have to so many places, particularly in the country areas.
And what drew you to working across rural New South Wales?
Well, I was teaching in Kempsey, and I had a connection with the Bell Shakespeare Group in Sydney. And I took my entire 2-year 10 classes from Kempsey, and I took them to Sydney. And it's when you realise there's the sheer cost of busing, 50 students to Sydney. Your day in Sydney, you've got a day's travel either side of that because it's a 6-7 hour drive on a bus. You've got accommodation, you've got your tickets, and it's not just the sheer cost, but we're talking, you're in the vicinity of, $6,000-$7,000 to offer that opportunity. Plus, the kids are then playing catch up again for the subjects that they've missed. So it's a huge imposition. So I've looked at the possibility of incursions and how I could make something mobile. And unfortunately, there are some great talents in Sydney who run incursions for history and different subjects, but they're not willing to put in that effort to get to the country. But hey, we've stuck to a mandate of our business. We're going to do a minimum of 70% in rural areas, and we're sitting around 80% now, and I'm on the road for about 150 days of the year in able to facilitate that. But
that was founder of Crime Story Australia and former detective Luke Taylor speaking with 1RPH Sarah Guys. Rural Australians make up a third of the population and inject around $500 billion into the national economy each year. But when it comes to healthcare, they're being left out. A report from National Rural Health Alliance reveals a staggering $6.5 billion gap in the healthcare fund for rural areas, with maternity care as the focal cause for concern. The Wire's Artem Rednikin spoke with Susan Tenegan, the Chief Executive of National Rural Health Alliance, for more.
The National Rural Health Alliance commissioned a report and review of the expenditure, which includes things like Medicare expenditure, PBS, so that's medicines, and hospital expenditure in rural, remote and regional Australia, where 30% of the population, or 7.3 million people, live. And we found that there's currently a $6.55 billion underspend, which means it's per person about $850 less expenditure for people that live outside of urban centres. It's not something that has just occurred overnight or in the last 3 years. It's something that's been building over many, many years. And at the same time as this less and less spending in rural communities, we've got less and less workforce in the communities because people are retiring or do not wish to go to those communities. And it's quite unfortunate because some of it is actually preventable. Those people that live in rural, remote and regional communities are also just as worthy of being able to access the services. And, in remote areas, some people are dying 13 years earlier than people in the city. And for a Western country, that's bad.
And why do you think those issues with rural healthcare system have been overlooked for so long? And what kind of support do rural families need from the government at the moment?
All Australians pay taxes or have paid taxes. They pay their Medicare levy. They also contribute to the economy. And rural Australia contributes 2/3 of Australia's export income and also provides 90% of the food and 50% of the tourism income. So they are great contributors to the Australian economy and society. And so the fact that they are receiving less healthcare gives a very clear indication that the way we are funding healthcare for those communities is not fit for purpose. Part of that is because of the inflexibility of the funding. Part of it is because of the workforce not being supported on the ground, and we're not training enough rural, remote and regional Australian people to work in those communities. And we're probably not doing enough rural research either. And so the opportunities are definitely there. The government has had quite a few different reviews over the last 2 or 3 years. For example, the National Health Reform Agreement, which is a state and federal government agreement, which they're currently going through. So we hope that they will agree to have a national rural health strategy to support where market fails. I think that's a really important strategy. There've also been some scope of practice reviews by the federal government, and some really good recommendations have come out. And we're hoping that now that they've come back into government after the election, that all of those reviews and reforms that have occurred over the last few years will actually address the issues of why rural, remote and regional Australia has not been able to access the funding nor the health service delivery that they deserve.
Could you please explain why are so many rural hospitals losing their birthing facilities, and what impact does that have on families and communities?
It's a real problem because 14% of babies born in remote areas are preterm, compared to 7.9% babies born in major cities. If people live outside of urban centres, many of them now will have to go to urban centres for anything of 2 to 3 months before they are due to deliver, which will cause great anxieties amongst mothers, but also families that rely on, you know, both parents being at home.
That was Susan Teagan, the Chief Executive from National Rural Health Alliance, speaking with Artem Rednikin. Rhinos in Africa have been under threat from an illicit demand for their horn. Reasons for the demand are rooted in Asian traditional medicine. But with modern medicine such as paracetamol, many see this belief as a myth. For the last 17 years, two or three rhinos have been poached for their horns in South Africa. The horns are then smuggled by Vietnamese criminal syndicates, mostly by plane, to Vietnam, and then either consumed there or transshipped to China. The Wire's Anita Diamond spoke with Dr. Michael Smith, journalist and Griffith University PhD researcher, for more.
So I read that, from what you've said, that up until 2016, the Vietnamese government was doing very little to fight this illegal trade. There were no prosecutions or sentences for the rhino horn smugglers. I wanted to ask, why do you think that was?
One of the issues with illegal wildlife trade was many countries, not just Vietnam, particularly Vietnam, but many countries didn't treat it seriously enough. The push that came about thanks to Great Britain convening four conferences, at which one was in Hanoi, which is capital Vietnam, 2016, was to treat the rhino horn trade and the illegal wildlife trade seriously. And there is a thing called serious crime. It's a classification of crime. So other transnational organized crime gets classified as serious crime. So that would include drug trafficking, human trafficking, weapons trafficking. Now, illegal wildlife trafficking is considered a serious crime. So it comes under stricter guidelines, and there's a minimum sentence of 4 years, whereas pre-2016, people were walking away with nothing. So that's been a strong finding of my research. And the analysis of the media in Vietnam showed Vietnam was taking it on as a serious crime.
Do you think there should be more international pressure on countries like Vietnam to stop the trade of rhino horns, for example, like NGOs and the United Nations?
Vietnam's been under lots of pressure. Vietnam came under the spotlight in 2016 for societies. They said, you guys aren't doing anything. Like, why haven't you got any prosecutions? You know, you've got seizures, like they're seizing the horn at the airports, but these guys are just walking away. Since that time, Vietnam really got tougher and wanted to show the world that they were getting tough on it. And part of my research showed that they actually got very tough on it, possibly tough in the same way that, you know, Nixon got tough on war on crime, war on drugs, drugs, that kind of tough, which doesn't necessarily get results.
It sounds like from about 2016, they began to declare war on rhino horn trade. And I wanted to ask, do you think now, is there being more done and is it enough? Is it drastic enough? Or perhaps, in your opinion, do you think it's too drastic? Does it help in curbing the levels of trafficking?
What's happening is there are some prosecutions and some sentencings going on now. The main people who get prosecuted and sentenced are what you would call couriers who are transporting the horn. They're getting 4 years plus, the low-level guys. And my research shows that those low-level guys are often migrant workers. Vietnam has a really strong migrant worker kind of economy, and they send their workers over to different countries. So a migrant worker might go over to Angola and they'll work for fairly low rates in Angola, and the syndicates will approach that person and say, we'll pay for a ticket. You can go back and visit your son, your mum, your wife, your family. We'll pay for the ticket and we'll give you $50 and you carry this. So the kingpins occasionally get done, but mainly it's the couriers.
To me, it sounds like it's not really going to solve the problem if you're not going after the crime syndicates, the people who are actually organizing this trade and probably the ones making the profits, I dare say, off it. Do you think that censorship of the media and government levels of corruption are contributing to this problem of the rhino horn trade?
My research tends to show that the rhino horn trade's not what you'd call a particularly sensitive topic in Vietnam. So being not sensitive means that journalists can report on it. And this is reflected in the amount of reports that are in the online newspapers, you know, in the sample that I researched. However, corruption is very sensitive and journalists have to negotiate very carefully how they report on corruption. Some journalists seem adept at reporting on low-level corruption in customs on the borders, but others tend to just stick to the official information that's contained in press releases, which is a pretty safe way of reporting on a sensitive topic.
That was Dr. Michael Smith, journalist and Griffith University PhD researcher, speaking with The Wire's Anita Diamond. An Australian university student has outlined that more than half of university students do not believe they can afford to put food on their table, as well as not eating enough. This has been an ongoing problem for several years, but it is continually getting worse. These issues contribute to physical and mental health problems, including massive decline in academic performance. The Wire's Thomas Curtis spoke with Dr. Catherine Bennett, Senior Lecturer in Nutrition and Dietetics at the University of Wollongong, for more.
We are researchers at universities and we're also academic teachers. So we teach a lot of students all across the country. And what we're noticing anecdotally is that students are really doing it tough. So in order to have a look at this further, we've conducted surveys over several years to look at food insecurity. So what food insecurity is when students are worried about not having enough money for food, or whether they're cutting the quality or the quantity of the food that they eat because they don't have enough money. And what our surveys have found is that food insecurity is not just getting more common, but it's getting more severe as the years go by. So we've conducted research in March of 2022 with a large survey of students at the University of Tasmania. And within that survey, about 40% of students told us that they were experiencing food insecurity. And then we've surveyed students again at the University of Tasmania in March of last year. And what we found is that now one in two, so over 50% of students, are now experiencing food insecurity. But really worryingly, what we noticed was a big increase in the number of students who are experiencing severe food insecurity.
Going on to cost, is this related to the cost of living?
Undoubtedly, this big increase in food insecurity is related to the cost of food. We know that over the years of 2022 to 2024, the cost of food, in particular the cost of healthy food in Australia, has increased. And what we also know is that the money that students have to purchase food isn't actually keeping up with the growth in inflation.
So our study didn't directly explore the causes of food insecurity among students, but we think that the cost of food is definitely a contributing factor, in addition to the higher rents that students are experiencing.
How many students on average are going without food? Is the stats alarming? Is this national-wide that you've noticed this in?
We think that the statistics are alarming. If more than half of the students who are attending university are compromising on the food that they're eating because they don't have enough money for food, that's going to be impacting their mental health and their physical health. And very concerningly for universities, it's going to be impacting their academic performance and their ability to actually continue at university at all. Although the University of Tasmania is doing a great thing by surveying their students about this problem so that they can try to respond to it, this problem is not isolated to that university. Indeed, I work at the University of Wollongong, and a study that we did in 2022 also showed that one in two students are experiencing food insecurity, and other research from metropolitan universities like Macquarie University is also producing similar statistics when they talk to their students about food insecurity. So what that means is this is not just an isolated case in one university, but it's actually becoming the new normal, and it's a widespread issue across every academic institution in the country.
That was Dr. Catherine Bennett, Senior Lecturer in Nutrition and Dietetics at the University of Wollongong, speaking to the Wire's Thomas Curden. And that's the end of today's show. Thanks so much for your company. The Wire Weekly is a collaboration between radio stations 2SER in Sydney, Radio 4EB in Brisbane, and contributors from stations across the country. With the great support from the Walkley Foundation and the Community Radio Network. We'll see you next time with the stories making headline across your community and Indigenous radio, at the same time on your local station. Check out all of our week's stories on our website at thewire.org.au and follow us on social media. Just search The Wire Radio, all one word, on X, or on Facebook and Instagram at thewire-independent current affairs on radio around Australia. The Wire acknowledges the Wurundjeri Woi-wurrung people of the Kulin Nations, the traditional custodians of the land where this program is produced. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. Today, The Wire Weekly is brought to you by Radio 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. I'm Amina Shiku. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time with more stories on The Wire Weekly.